I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 25th of March. The editorial board of the International New York Times had a piece on March 23rd, titled Willfully Endangering Drivers. And it goes like this. The delayed recalls of millions of defective cars by Toyota and General Motors put the American public at risk and shows glaring deficiencies in enforcement of auto safety regulations. Our guest this hour has been with us many times before, talking about cars and actually alternative to cars as well. Mickey Maynard is a visiting professor at Arizona State University. She is an award-winning journalist, former bureau chief, and senior business correspondent at the New York Times based in Detroit. She's editor of Curbing Cars Journalism Project, which looks at changing attitudes toward personal transportation. In a piece she wrote for Forbes last week, Mickey says on Wednesday of last week, the Justice Department and Toyota announced a stunning $1.2 billion settlement over cases of unintended acceleration in millions of Toyota and Lexus companies. Under the settlement, Toyota admitted that it misled U.S. consumers by concealing and making deceptive statements about two safety issues involving its vehicles and the safety defect. And now, of course, we have GM under close scrutiny as well. And we'll talk about both of those cases and how it could possibly be that if a car company knows it has defects, why it would willfully mislead the public about those defects and it resulted in deaths of human beings. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and our Twitter is @KDunnShow. We'll be looking at the Motor Vehicle Safety Act. We'll talk about the National Highway Safety Administration, which is supposed to be investigating auto defects, but evidently they don't have very many people to do a pretty large task. And, of course, we'll be looking at the behavior of these two companies. And, Mickey, thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. It's my pleasure to be back.
Nice to have you with us. I find these stories very disturbing. And, of course, the big disturbing part of this is that the companies would know that they had these substantial problems and they just kept it under wraps and people died.
Yeah, I realize that it does sound very disturbing. And, in fact, as a journalist covering this, it's very frustrating because a lot of times only the car companies have access to information that a lot of us think should be public. And even when it is made public, sometimes the information is blocked out or redacted because it's considered sensitive to a company's operations. Mm. So this is something I can understand would distress many people.
And why is it not made public?
Well, first of all, competitive reasons. So General Motors and Toyota are two of the biggest car companies in the world, actually the two biggest car companies in the world. They have tons of competitors. They have Fiat Chrysler. They have Ford. They have all the Japanese, the Germans, the Korean automakers. And everyone tries to keep their engineering a secret. So if too much information gets out through government data or public information, then your competitors will know what you're up to. Honestly, I think there aren't that many secrets in the auto industry anymore, and so public safety probably outweighs the need for corporate secrecy.
Well, tell me, we have to, I guess, surmise what's going on here, but maybe there were some internal documents released in both of these cases. If you know that you have a problem with your accelerator, if you know that the car stops moving with the ignition, if it's too heavy or if something hits it, what kind, and people have died as a result of that. Obviously, somebody is investigating this. Who's making a decision within a company to determine how to handle that situation?
So I want to point your listeners to a couple of stories that they might want to look at that just broke in the last 24 hours,
okay.
really. In today's New York Times, there's a very interesting piece about the people whose Chevrolet, Saturn, and other General Motors vehicles had this ignition defect. And they look at 12 specific stories of people who whose cars were damaged, who got into accidents. And it talks about GM's attorneys actually pushing back against people
yes.
when they tried to ask for compensation. And then another story in Automotive News actually got a hold of some GM court papers, but read through them, and page after page after page were blocked out. They couldn't see what the information was. However, they talked to three General Motors engineers about the way GM handled the situation internally, and surprisingly to me and to many people who know engineering, General Motors quietly changed the part on these vehicles but didn't register a new part number. And now the reason that this is meaningful is that an automobile has about 10,000 parts, and those parts are tracked by their numbers. So anytime you make an engineering change, you have to change the part number, and you have to tell the dealers, you have to tell the suppliers, you have to tell the government, and on and on and on and on. And so for GM to allegedly do this secretly means that they did camouflage the improvement that they made to the ignition part. Even people in GM didn't know that this was happening until a year ago, when an independent investigator hired by the company found that this part had been changed, but the part number had not been changed.
Oh, my goodness. Let's talk about the Toyota deal, which you wrote about last week. $1.2 billion settlement. It's a large settlement. Is it the biggest ever?
It's believed to be the biggest ever in the United States, and it's believed to be the first time an automaker has signed an agreement like this, where they actually admit criminal fault. And it was a stunning development for those of us who followed the Toyota case.
And Eric Holder said that they had violated this basic compact with the customers. He also said, and I wonder what this encompasses, that in the agreement there are requirements that Toyota will take further actions to prevent similar lapses in its behavior in the future. In return, the Justice Department defers prosecution. What will they have to do?
So there are two steps here. First of all, there's an independent monitor that was appointed to oversee Toyota's operations. And the parallel to this are some of the settlements that were reached in technology lawsuits where these independent monitors were named. And Toyota has to submit all kinds of documents and other information to this independent monitor that it wouldn't have to do if it hadn't violated the law, essentially. And the other step is that Toyota has, if you notice what's happening with Toyota, you know, we had the big spate of millions of recalls in 2009, and since then, many millions more Toyota vehicles have been recalled. And what's going on with Toyota is basically they're recalling everything. And anytime there's a problem now, they're erring on the side of caution and they're recalling vehicles. Obviously, not all those vehicles are defective, but they're basically telling people, if you have this model, this might go wrong with it. Take it into the dealer and we'll see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. When are they required to do a recall?
Well, there's a long investigative process that happens. And the way it usually starts is either with owner reports to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration in Washington, or owner reports to dealers, which are then passed on to Toyota. And so usually what NHTSA does is look at how many come in. Are there any similarities to these reports? Are there injuries and deaths because of these reports? And then they start to open investigations. Sometimes a company will get information and they'll just do the recall, or they'll do the safety notice. Sometimes they just tell you, we think this might happen with your car. We're not telling you to take it in, but this might happen. So there's a long process. Now, if NHTSA basically says, we've done an investigation, we think you should recall the vehicle, the car company might push back and say, we don't see a need to recall the vehicle. But nearly all recalls, in fact, all the recalls I can remember are now these voluntary recalls, because essentially, car makers don't want to be in a position of telling the government, we don't believe you, and, you know, we don't think our car is defective. We'll recall it. I mean, they basically recall pretty much what they're told to recall.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the National Highway Safety Administration. The New York Times has, as you know, been on this story for quite some time now. They were talking about the fact that this agency only had 28 investigators last year, barely up from 26 in 2001 after Congress passed the last major auto safety law.
Mm-hmm, that's true. And we found that out during the Toyota recalls in 2008 and 2009, that NHTSA just does not have a very big staff. And it's true across government. If you think about aviation accidents and you look at the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, they're low on investigators as well. This is the kind of thing where a lot of there's always a lot of calls for more investigators, and they don't seem to get funded by Congress.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, Mickey, about there being the ability to pursue criminal penalties in cases where these automakers conceal information about these very serious defects?
Well, it's happened in the case of Toyota. There was a settlement with the Justice Department, but Toyota has also faced a number of civil lawsuits at the same time. So this settlement with the Justice Department is basically to avoid criminal prosecution. There are civil suits where obviously Toyota's made a number of settlements as well. In the General Motors case, this is going to get more complicated because the vehicles that are involved in the most publicized GM recalls, these Saturns and Chevrolet Cobalts, those were produced before General Motors filed for bankruptcy. So those, the liability for those recalls stays with the old version of General Motors, which is called Motors Holding. And their liability for these is limited. If it was happening after General Motors filed for bankruptcy, reconstituted as the new GM, they would face a higher liability for these problems. But the bankruptcy seems to be the dividing line, and that's going to become, I think, controversial as this case moves forward.
And the case will be moving forward with congressional hearings fairly soon. Is that what you're hearing, Mickey?
Yes. Mary Barra, who is General Motors' new chief executive, and she's also the first woman chief executive in Detroit, she will be testifying before Congress on April 1st.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We have a number of people who would like to speak to these issues, so let's go. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. We're talking about the Toyota settlement announced by Eric Holder and also about the GM situation. They have a recall of 1.6 million cars equipped with a faulty ignition switch that is now thought to be linked to at least a dozen deaths. The internal GM timeline indicating that the carmaker first knew of this malfunctioning switch as early as 2001. And of course, there has been a case in Wisconsin where three young women were driving one of these cars and two were killed because of that faulty ignition. What do you think? Why is this happening? How can we make certain that cars that are made really go through rigorous safety procedures? Are they going through that? Or is there some fault with that that allows cars that may have these kinds of deadly faults to be put on the market? We welcome your thoughts. And let's start with Corey in Milwaukee. Hello, Corey.
Hey, Kathleen. How are you doing today?
All right. How are you?
What I was calling about is what they call bean counters that work for these big companies that they can figure out statistically what it's going to cost the company to retrofit or recall as opposed to paying out penalties and fines and lawsuits, and they take the cheaper route. Whether it costs human lives or not is really irrelevant to them. They look at the bottom dollar, and that's just my opinion, and I thought I'd throw that out there.
All right. Thanks, Corey. Mickey, what do you think?
Well, there's definitely a feeling like that. Like Corey was saying, that there is a financial calculation that goes on here. I think if you ask the CEO or the senior executives at any of the car companies, they would absolutely insist that human lives come first and the safety of their customers come first, and that if there's something that they can fix or repair, that they'll do it. I think what is causing an issue here is that General Motors has some intentions with these vehicles. For instance, they have said that anyone with the affected vehicle can get a loaner car. And, you know, if you don't feel safe driving it, don't drive it and we'll take care of you. And then we've seen responses on the web, on comment boards, on various automotive websites, that people are going into dealers and the dealers are not giving them loaner cars. They're basically pushing back at them. And so that's a little bit of the disconnect. You know, you have car companies that make the vehicles, but they're sold through dealers. And there can be sometimes, you know, not clear communication between the company and what it tells the dealers and what dealers tell people.
Obviously, Toyota wants people to buy Toyotas. GM wants people to buy GM cars. This is horrible publicity for both of these companies. Does it make these kinds of cases people switch brands?
You know, right after Toyota had its issues, its sales, its first of all, its profits plummeted when it recalled all those vehicles. And it also was, it was right after the recession or right during the recession. So probably the recession plus the recalls combined for Toyota, and it lost a significant amount of market share. It is pretty much climbing back to its market share, but there are some studies showing that it affected its brand for about 2 years before it got back to where it was before all of the recalls took place.
Corey, thanks for your call. Mike in Chippewa Falls. Hey, Mike.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. You relate right into my question. I understand the government fining the corporation. I understand the personal lawsuits for those who were injured or families of those who were injured. Has there ever been a case, or is it ever done, where there is a class action lawsuit of shareholders of like Toyota that have lost money and potential earnings because of the action of either the CEO or head management? And what's going to happen with GM? Certainly it's not going to up their stock value.
Mickey.
That's a good question. I can't recall any by shareholders. I know there are instances where shareholders are upset about these kinds of situations. I know that Toyota faced some problems from shareholders when all this was going on. I don't believe there's actually been a class action lawsuit filed, though.
Is there a problem? We'll go back to calls in a moment, but is there a problem with all of the safety checks that are taking place after a car is ready to go on the market, or is that not a problem?
That's a good question. Let me explain to listeners a couple of things about automotive quality. First of all, automakers are measured by organizations like J.D. Power and Associates within the first year of ownership. They send out surveys to owners and basically say, Consumer Reports does this as well, how is your vehicle held up within the first year of ownership? And what you find is that pretty much vehicles are being built to initial quality standards that are all pretty good. The difference comes in 3 years out and 5 years out and beyond that. And one of the issues that the Detroit car makers have had in particular is that their long-term quality hasn't held up the same way that their initial quality has held up. Cars go through extensive checks when they leave the factory. I've watched them take place. They check, you know, 100 different things on the car to make sure it's working. So you don't have to, usually you don't have to worry about it right off of the dealership lot. The problems tend to pop up later on.
We welcome more phone calls in a moment. Mickey Maynard is our guest this hour of the program, and we're calling about the we're talking about the Toyota settlement that was announced last week, and we're also talking about the GM situation and welcoming your phone calls. Both involved safety situations that the companies knew about and did not make public, and as a result, there were accidents in some cases that resulted in people dying because of those vehicles. Mickey is a visiting professor right now at Arizona State University. She's always involved in a number of very interesting projects. I think the last time she was on, we talked about Curbing Cars, which is a journalism project that she's heading, looking at changing attitudes toward personal transportation. She was former bureau chief and senior business correspondent at the New York Times, based in Detroit. She has won many awards for her writing, and she knows her vehicles. More phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about the settlement, the large settlement, Toyota settlement announced by Eric Holder last week. And we're also looking at the GM's situation with faulty cars and welcoming your phone calls for Mickey Maynard, visiting professor at Arizona State University, former bureau chief, senior business correspondent at the New York Times. Jeff in Elmira, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. Does anybody find it coincidental that suddenly Toyota was under the microscope and had a rash of recalls during a time when GM was getting a major bailout and was about to lose its status as the number one car maker in the world to Toyota? Because it seems too, it doesn't seem coincidental. It seemed like this happened with intention.
Mickey.
Well, that actually came up during the congressional hearings when Akio Toyota testified before Congress in 2010, I believe. And basically, the transportation secretary at the time, Ray LaHood, said that there was no coincidence, that there had actually been recalls of 23 million vehicles from all kinds of automakers. That it was just, it really was just a coincidence that Toyota ran into problems and the government investigated. I mean, if you follow the line of reasoning that, the government favors General Motors because it gave it a bailout, then you probably wouldn't be hearing very much about General Motors right now. And we're hearing a lot about General Motors.
Mm-hmm. Mickey, are there certain car companies that are known for their safety records? And when they do these crash tests, et cetera, are those valid indicators of what's safe and what's not?
So obviously the nameplate that a lot of people would think of is Volvo. And Volvo for years was known as the car company that basically built tanks on wheels. They always led a lot of the safety records. But what's happened over the last few years, I'd say last 10 years or so, is that all the car companies realize that they have to build safe vehicles. And one of the reasons why is that women actually now buy more new vehicles than men do.
Do they really?
They do. It's a little bit above 51%, and It switched over about 2 years ago. And safety and reliability is high on a woman's shopping list for a couple of reasons. First of all, they have kids. They're usually the ones driving the kids to band practice and soccer practice. And they also are not necessarily as interested in car repair as men are. They don't want to spend time in the dealership. They want the car to work. And so women will favor vehicles that have higher safety ratings, where men tend to think, I can fix this myself, or, well, yes, vehicles break down, but look at how fun this is to drive. And I don't mean to be stereotypical, but I have seen a number of studies that show that men and women look at vehicles differently.
Mm. Well, I like a car that's safe and fun to drive.
Yeah, I'd like to have that, too.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go to Dave in Wisconsin somewhere. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I just have a couple of personal observations. One question I wanted to ask is the Toyota with $1 billion settlement, and this is kind of off topic, but where is that money going to go to?
Let's get an answer. Answer that one real quickly.
Sure.
So, Dave, they actually have to wire the money. I think they...
By today?
Yesterday.
So I thought it was today.
The 24th?
They said so Tuesday.
So they actually have to wire $1.2 billion in cash, I guess, to the Justice Department. And then I guess the Justice Department does with it what it wants to do with it.
I'd be very curious to see where that money goes. but I'm not sure the criminal fault comes in. The information I've seen has indicated that even NASA investigated unwanted acceleration on the Toyotas and found no electronic faults. and the Lexus that started the whole episode, where I believe it was a police officer was killed because he could not stop the car, was observed, maybe even proven to have the wrong floor mats in it. And I see on a daily basis floor mats stacked on top of floor mats in cars. And I know from personal experience that floor mats get jammed underneath accelerator pedals. And it seems that people want to treat their car as a living room and not as a piece of machinery that needs to be intelligently and operated.
Mickey.
So you're absolutely right. One of the things that Toyota learned as it was investigating the sudden acceleration situation was that people did have two and three levels of floor mats, and not just flat carpet floor mats, but some people still like their shaggy carpet floor mats. There indeed was never proven a mechanical reason for the sudden acceleration in the Toyota vehicles. And yes, NASA did get involved in that. So that's one of the biggest mysteries, I think, surrounding the auto industry is what caused the sudden acceleration in those vehicles? Because I absolutely believe the consumers that say my vehicle accelerated suddenly and I couldn't control it. But we've never, at least Toyota has never, and the government has never found an absolute cause for that.
Mm-hmm. And that was a separate, I have read that the floor mat was one problem, but the accelerator would get sticky too. Was that a separate problem, Mickey?
That was a separate problem. And so the sticky accelerator pedal, actually I have a Toyota Prius and I had to take my vehicle in, and I believe what they did was lengthen the pedal. I'm sorry that the details aren't clear at the moment, but I think they went in and did a retrofit to the accelerator pedal in order to have it work more smoothly. And so that was a separate issue.
I see. And when we talk about the amount of this settlement, $1.2 billion, I think that you wrote an interesting article about how much profit Toyota is making and where $1.2 billion could go.
Mm-hmm. So $1.2 billion, I mean, obviously any of us would love to have $1.2 billion.
Right.
In the auto industry, $1.2 billion will pay for a new assembly plant. Basically, the last Toyota assembly plant built in Blue Springs, Mississippi, cost $800 million. So you could get an assembly plant and some extra land or something like that. $1 billion pays for a new car program. So if you want to develop a new vehicle from the wheels up, that's about what it will cost you. It costs you about $1 billion. And this is money that can be spent on all kinds of research. All the car companies are, as we were saying, we want exciting cars. We want them to be safe and we want them to be economical. And all the companies are facing these multiple demands by consumers. And so $1 billion in research money can go pretty far.
Let's go back to that aforementioned New York Times editorial. They talked about the Motor Vehicle Safety Act failing to pass in 2010 because of opposition from the auto industry and, according to them, Republican lawmakers. A proposal would have provided more money to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to investigate defects, instructed the agency to make more information available to the public from a database of early warnings that's made up of notices from car makers about potential defects, and given the regulator power to levy bigger fines against companies that did not recall faulty cars. Would you agree that it would be a good idea to look again and perhaps pass the Motor Vehicle Safety Act?
I'd like to see them pass at least the early warning system portion of it. Now, the one thing you have to remember is that there's a lot of raw data that goes to the federal government there. So, for example, there was a story a couple of weeks ago that there was raw data showing that 303 additional people had died in accidents involving the General Motors vehicles. The problem with the raw data is that you have to go through it and match up the cause of the accident to the people who were involved in the accident, to the repair record of the vehicle and all that. So it makes it a cumbersome, time-consuming process. And for a lot of people who don't understand what the data is, they might jump in and jump to conclusions. But I am totally in favor of transparency, and I think that the early warning system information ought to be available to journalists, to the public, to government regulators, to anyone to whom it would be useful.
Do you see any signs that somebody will again introduce the Motor Vehicle Safety Act?
Well, it's getting late. It is getting late in this session of Congress. I mean, I know it really it's only March, but when you have an election year,
yes,
generally work stops around, I would say, May or June. So I think this would be the kind of matter that might have to come up after the election. And we also have to see where the Obama administration comes down on this after the election and what the priorities are, because it just, you know, it hasn't been a priority for this president. He's had many, many bigger issues to deal with, even though I realize for those affected by these accidents, this is the number one issue for them.
And yet Eric Holder's comments were pretty strong last week, weren't they?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think in the case of Toyota, it's a landmark settlement to get a car company to admit that they misled the public. I mean, as a term of the settlement, they had to publicly admit that and basically apologize yet again on that. So that's a win for Eric Holder in pursuing Toyota.
Thanks, Dave, for your call. We go next to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I'm here to defend the car lots, actually. I work for a major car lot in Green Bay here, and they talk about safety. That's all we care about is safety. So, I mean, not all car lots are evil. And like I said, I mean, we got recall cars, and that they do anything they can to bend over backwards to help people. So, I mean, I love working there just because of the safety aspect.
Okay.
That was my comment.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
That's great, Nick. And I have a great dealer that looks after my Prius, and I know that they're always giving me advice on what I should look at next when I bring the car in. So I totally agree with you. There are a lot of dealers that have helped a lot of customers out there, but there are also probably as many people who would call in and say, I've had a tough time with a car dealer. So keep up the good work in Green Bay.
Thanks, Nick, for the call. Michael in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I think that we're being a little bit too tough on our automakers and on our auto manufacturers. I think we're expecting them to come up to a near perfect standard, which is pretty much impossible. I don't really agree with this $1.2 billion. I don't agree with all of these big lawsuits against manufacturers for what I would consider a lot of times small, trivial things. As you said, there's 10,000 parts in an automobile. People feel today like they're supposed to be protected from cradle to grave. Nothing is ever supposed to go wrong, and they're never supposed to accept any risk. Every time you get in that vehicle, there's risk. And I'm old enough. I'm 68 years old. I'm old enough to remember when cars really weren't safe. The cars that they build today are incredibly reliable. They are so safe. I think they've raised the level to safety in vehicles today, and I forget, my wife knows the phrase for it. I can't think of it right now. But people drive like maniacs because they know they probably aren't going to get hurt even if they get an accident, and with all the airbags and whatnot, all that are in cars. That being said, if the people, the drivers themselves, if they would probably hold themselves to 10% of the standard that they expect the automobile to meet, we wouldn't be in such a mess. I mean, if you go out on the road, people drive like knuckleheads. The last caller mentioning all these extra floor mats and stuff, people have stuff hanging from their mirror where they shouldn't. They can't see. So anyways, I think that we expect too much out of our manufacturers, our automakers. Somebody has to pay for this. A lot of this money goes into attorneys' pockets. And sometimes stuff just happens. One little side note to that, for a population that constantly wants the government to be out of our lives, as soon as something doesn't go right, the first thing you hear is, where's the government?
All right.
That's about it.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for your call. Mickey.
The one thing that I would say about Michael's comments, and I think he reflects the feeling of a lot of people out there, especially about the way folks drive. The vehicle is the second most expensive thing that most people buy in their lifetime next to their house. The average car now costs $33,000, and that's a lot of money a lot of people. Yeah, and so I think that people get frustrated. First of all, and they spend a lot of time in their cars, too, the ones that use them for commuting. So people get frustrated because they're spending hundreds of dollars a month on a car payment, and they want it to basically operate the way that the car maker tells them it's going to operate. I do think there is some a responsibility on people to be safe drivers and not to push their luck, but I do understand why folks are very upset about these problems.
Well, sure. You also want to have your company act in good faith with you, and if they know of a problem, they darn well better let you know about it.
Right, and this GM ignition situation is a pretty significant situation. This isn't just an issue of someone driving the car too fast and something
right.
bad happened. This is the ignition failing to work, and when the ignition doesn't work, you lose control of a lot of systems in the car, and this is something that is even perplexed General Motors engineers as well. So this one, I think, all the scrutiny possible. This is not related to the way people drive. This is related to a mechanical defect.
Because in this case, it's my understanding that if this happened, the ignition went off, you're not going to have airbags deploy either, right?
Right. So it's electrical power, it's airbag, it's your power steering, your power brakes. Mm. And honestly, if you're used to those things. Now, I've been reading comments on message boards saying, you know, everyone should be taught to drive the car without power. But most people are not. You go to driver's ed when you're 16 and then you just sort of learn how the car works after that. We're not taken out in parking lots and taught how to drive, how to drive without power, how to move the car over to the side of the road. So you have to understand people under normal operating circumstances simply don't know how to react to a problem like this.
Gary is next in Madison. Hello.
Yes, hi. I think I feel that that Toyota is even more culpable here than GM. For heaven's sakes, they denied this for over a year, and $1,100,000 for a criminal act. I get a kick out of my liberal friends, and I'm one of them. But the Toyota has always been the darling of the liberal crowd. In fact, I remember when I was collecting signatures for Walker, the teachers would roll up in their Toyota. It, and yet they wouldn't support their brothers and sisters in Detroit under the union. So I have always bought American, and I'll tell you, I will continue to. I think that they should just be ashamed of themselves to have denied this for so many years, and now they've gotten what they have coming to them. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. I don't know if you want to respond, Mickey.
Well, I do want to say that when I was at the New York Times, we did investigate what was happening with Toyota and the recalls, and we did find evidence that there were actions taken in Europe and Japan before they were taken in the United States. And I think we thought that was pretty inexcusable to treat other sets of customers differently than their set of customers in the United States.
Oh, that's interesting.
It doesn't really have anything to do with Buy American or not Buy American. I mean, these General Motors vehicles were built in Ohio and Tennessee, you know. So we buy American in that case, and you might have a problem with your ignition. So it isn't just Toyota, and it isn't just General Motors either. A lot of automakers run into problems with their cars.
And why did Toyota treat European customers differently?
Well, one of the issues with Toyota, and people probably don't understand this, is that vehicles outside the United States generally cost more than they do here. We're pretty lucky, in quotation marks, market. In Europe, people generally pay about 25% more for the same vehicle. And the other issue with Europe is their sales there are significantly smaller than they are in the United States. So it's a situation where someone has paid more for the car and you have fewer of them, you can move more quickly and you want to move quickly to fix them because there's more money at stake. And in Japan is Toyota's home market, and Toyota has always based some of its operations, significant operations, in Japan, as we found out during that whole recall crisis.
Yes.
Now Toyota is pushing some of the authority to the local markets, meaning that a situation like this probably wouldn't happen again the way it did in 2009.
We welcome more phone calls, and we, for the first time, have a few lines available. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking with Mickey Maynard this hour of the program about Toyota's settling last week, and now we're looking at the GM recall and civil lawsuits and GM being in more than a bit of trouble over the accelerators just turning off. On Wednesday of last week, the Justice Department and Toyota announced this $1.2 billion settlement over cases of unintended acceleration in millions of Toyota and Lexus companies. Mickey knows her cars. She's been writing about cars and transportation for the New York Times, and she is also right now editor of Curbing Cars, a new journalism project that looks at changing attitudes toward personal transportation. 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now. Al in Land O'Lakes. Hi, Al.
Hi. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I've been following this, and it brings out the dreaded cost-benefit analysis. You know, it's profit versus dead people. And I hope you don't know anyone or have any relatives that were killed by this. It's an immoral, illegal cover-up. It's a conspiracy. So my question is, will anyone be prosecuted for this? You know, it's like climate change, you know. It's a kind of a conspiracy. And will our great-grandkids have to relocate to a different planet because it's being covered up for profit? And then I had one more question. Does anybody remember Ralph Nader? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thank you for the call, Mickey.
Well, Ralph Nader remembers Ralph Nader because he's very much still alive.
He sure is.
And his Center for Auto Safety has been one of the leaders in the whole General Motors situation in making information available on these vehicles. In terms of the cost-benefit analysis, you know, this is one of the parts of business that people don't like very much. You want to think that a human life has value over everything else, but there are some financial calculations that do go on within corporations. I'm not going to talk about the morality of it or not, but I do want to say that in this situation, the information that we've gotten is not complete. And more information keeps coming out. The more reporters go through court records, the more they go through federal data, the more we're finding out. And it's almost a situation where I wish that a car company, and I'm not talking about GM, Toyota, or anybody in particular, but I just wish there'd be one time when a car company would get a hold of all this information and go through it and present its own analysis before reporters do it piecemeal. I mean, I understand that they feel that there's different kinds of legal liabilities and they can't do that and et cetera, et cetera. But just once, I'd like to see a car company that doesn't stall and doesn't make it difficult for people to get information and that comments when reporters bring information to them. There's the story that I mentioned in Automotive News that folks should take a look at, talking to the engineers about the GM ignition situation. You know, that's a pretty significant story, and there's a no comment from General Motors in it. And I really wish just once that car companies would sit down with the good journalists, you know, the ones that want to give them a fair shake and deal with them on this.
And they don't because?
Well, liability. I mean, I can totally understand that they would say, hey, you've talked to three guys. We haven't had a chance to talk to the three guys. Let us do our research and get back to you. But, you know, there's all kinds of documents out there that reporters are finding, and you have to just assume the GM has them as well. And, you know, if the reporters are hitting on stuff that's in the documents, they should be ready to comment
on
them.
Right, yeah. Al, thanks for the call. Rich in New Berlin. Hi.
Hi. My friend's son worked for one of the big three as an engineer, and one of his big complaints that I've talked to him about is the fact that he'll design something you know, build a prototype, take it in for approval, and then he'll be told, well, now take it back and make it 9 cents cheaper. You know, in contrast to some of the European countries, Mercedes, Volvo, who constantly try to make it better.
Have you heard that criticism, Mickey?
I sure have. And in fact, if you go on the Forbes website, look, do search for a story that Joanne Mueller wrote that talks about the China price. Because apparently, and this was something that the Bloomberg News Service found out, the engineers at General Motors were pushed to cut the prices of components to the similar prices in China. And it was called the China price. And they were constantly told, we have to be competitive with China. We can't be more expensive than the vehicles or the parts that we get from China. You know, you have to get the price down. And I remember hearing stories like that and thinking, well, you know, they do have to stay in business. You can understand that they do want to keep costs low, but there does come a tipping point where cheap costs can lead to cheap parts, which can break. And it's possible that that's what's happened here in the ignition situation.
Thank you, Rich. Brian in Burlington, hi.
Hello. I have a question. I heard that heavy key rings might be the fault for this ignition problem, and I was just wondering if GM might have notified owners of this problem or given them some kind of warning that heavy key rings could be cause ignition problems. Take my question.
Okay.
Out.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, Brian, it isn't that the key rings themselves cause the ignition problem, but General Motors is asking people if they do own one of these affected vehicles, which is essentially 2003 to 2007 Ions, Cobalts from 2005 to 2007, and some other vehicles, it is asking them not to have anything on the key ring just so that the heavy key ring doesn't tip the ignition into the wrong position. You know, most people I know have at least a grocery store card, their gym card, a couple of other things on their key ring. And what GM is saying is just use the key. Don't have all that stuff on the key for now until we figure this out.
Another Brian from Superior this time. Hello.
Yes, I just want to make a comment. I owned a Toyota Prius. And when I bought the car new, it was very securely, the floor mat was very securely attached to the floor. I see absolutely no way that Toyota can use the excuse that it was the floor mats causing that acceleration problem. And one of the reasons that I come to that conclusion is I had the same vehicle that my mom had, and we both experienced computer problems. My mom took the car in and was told that there were a lot of computer problems with that Toyota Prius, and what would happen is the computer would not respond to any of the controls. There were a lot of times when I would be going down the road, I couldn't use the air conditioner, I couldn't use the radio. Anything that was on stayed in its current configuration. You couldn't change it, and you had an extremely hard time getting the car to shut off. So that's my comment, and I really think Toyota's covering that up.
Thank you for the call, Brian. Mickey?
Well, one last point on floor mats. One of the situations with the floor mats wasn't the factory floor mats. It was people adding floor mats on top of the factory floor mats. So that was found to be one of the issues with the sticking pedals, I believe. In terms of the computers on the car, you know, I had a Volkswagen where the computer had to be regularly reset every time I took it in. It would just go off. I've had a few issues with my Prius where if you hit a bump, you get that little light that comes on that says, you know, you have the stability control has just clicked in on the car. And so, you know, especially as cars become more electrically controlled, they're more like computers. Mm-hmm. They're tougher to fix because, you know, you have to reboot them essentially because they're just like a computer. I mean, I've always said that the on-off switch is probably the most important part of a computer. And sometimes with an automobile, you just have to shut it down and turn it back on.
Hmm. And that's also been mentioned as one of the problems in trying to diagnose problems with cars. They're more complicated now. Is that correct?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And there's a great demand for people who can be diagnostic technicians, which is basically what mechanics are now. I mean, you need to be able to be familiar with computers, computer commands, and then the mechanical part starts. So I was going to say, if you have any young listeners who are looking for jobs, I would highly recommend that they consider the automobile technician field.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like there will be a lot of jobs in this area. Philip on email says, as a retired engineer, he was shocked to hear that the ignition switch had been changed without changing the part number. That suggests to him anyway that GM was actively working to conceal the issue.
Yeah, we don't know why. We've only got that information in the automotive news story and in some of the court documents. We don't know why that would have happened. And frankly, as someone who knows manufacturing very well, I'm pretty shocked if that's true, because in manufacturing, you keep track of everything down to the length of an eyelash. I mean, you're tracking every single possible issue that could go on with a car. And if you do something as major as an update to an ignition, you would definitely have that a paper trail on that.
Mickey, thank you very, very much for being with us. And I guess, you know, the other part of this is take the bus when you can and look for mass transit. I know you're working on that as well, which I find interesting. It's always a great pleasure to speak with you, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Mickey Maynard, visiting professor now at Arizona State University, the Walter Cronkite Center there. She worked at the New York Times, former bureau chief, senior business correspondent based in Detroit. And she is editor now of Curbing Cars. It's a very interesting, we've talked to Mickey about this before on the air. It's a journalism project that looks at changing attitudes toward personal transportation, and we really are driving a whole lot less now than we used to. That's another show. We'll be on it. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for doing on-air production, and thanks to Marika Suval for producing this interesting show.